Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. Gene Moore is guest hosting today's program.
Our conversation is on the Tulsa, Oklahoma race riot of 1921. My guest, Mr. Tim Madigan, is an award-winning writer with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and author of a recent book titled The Burning, with a cover subtitle Massacre, Destruction, and the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. Welcome to University Forum, Mr. Madigan.
Good morning. I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, The Burning is indeed an apt title for what was a horrendous series of events that took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in June of 1921. You know, I visited the Greenwood Memorial in Tulsa a few years ago, and although I've read a number of things on this, and I know where the tragedy occurred, and things that were written even shortly after the riot, I found myself, in reading your book, completely overwhelmed by the way in which you developed this very evil kind of past event. Explain to others, though, why you call this The Burning. What happened there over 80 years ago?
Well, for one thing, calling it the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, I think, is as gross a misnomer as anything I've ever come across, because it wasn't a riot in any kind of way that word can be defined. It was a massacre. It was as close to ethnic cleansing as I think we've ever come, or we've come in this century on our soil. And it was quite literally a burning, in which a mob of upwards of or up to 10,000 white people massed themselves on the borders of this uniquely affluent African-American community on the north side of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And after overcoming some pretty fierce resistance from the black people who were trying to defend their homes and businesses, systematically torched and burned 35 square blocks of this community, including everything from homes to businesses to hospitals to schools to churches, in the aftermath, the photographs can only be compared to Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombings in 1945.
Yeah, you're so right in terms of the term riot. I talked with someone about this some time ago, and the question was that I asked at that time was that riots today are thought of in the terms of what happened to the communities that were burned, if you will, during the 60s.
Right.
And the riots being blacks or disenchanted or disadvantaged persons burning their own buildings at times or buildings where they lived. But this was very different, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, the only reason that we decided to include the Tulsa Race Riot in the title of the book at all, in the subtitle, was because that's how this event has come to be known in history.
Yes.
And you know, so people would know immediately what we're talking about. But I would hope that one of the things, you know, one of many things that I hope a reader would come away from my book with was the sense that this was not a riot. This was not something precipitated by the black people in Tulsa. That this was pure evil, as you describe, in which the whites were the perpetrators and the African Americans of Tulsa were the victims. And to call it a riot, I think, is abominable, actually.
Of course, as some others might say, perhaps they think that the blacks were the ones who did precipitate it. Tell exactly how events unfolded. What actually happened there?
Well, as was so often the case in those days, it began with an accusation against a young black man who had been accused by a teenage white girl of assault on an elevator. These charges later proved to be dubious, and this young fellow was never actually prosecuted. But in the days after this allegation was made, in those days, in that period of our history, the truth often was irrelevant. And this young fellow was arrested, and the police were in the process of investigating the charges against him and finding them to be dubious. but a white newspaper editor in Tulsa by the name of Richard Lloyd Jones, who basically was played the race card at that time to try to sell newspapers, printed highly inflammatory news accounts of his arrest with a front page editorial that has since disappeared from the archives of all surviving newspapers.
Now, you mentioned that you haven't been able to find any of those, and those that you found had that section cut out.
Then there's in the archived, on the microfiche of that particular edition of the newspaper in the Tulsa Public Library, there's a big hole in the right-hand corner of the front page where that editorial was. And while no one can remember exactly what the editorial said, the headline can never be forgotten by the people who saw it, and the headline was, "To Lynch Negro Tonight." When the whites saw that, of course, and Tulsa was as lawless a place as probably existed any place in the country because of the oil field activity and other things that were going on, a crowd of whites began to mass at the courthouse where this guy was being held. The white sheriff, or the sheriff at the time, vowed to protect this guy and tried to disperse the crowd, which just kept growing and growing and growing. The same headline was being passed hand-to-hand down in Greenwood. This affluent community full of World War I veterans who had come back from the war determined that the atrocities had been perpetrated against their people in the United States were not going to be done without some sort of defense in Tulsa. So they themselves went down to the courthouse to try to protect this young black named Dick Rowland, made one trip down there, were assured by the sheriff in the midst of this white mob that the guy was safe, went back to Greenwood. Another rumor got to them that in fact a lynch mob had taken over the courthouse, which later proved to be false. They went back to the courthouse en masse, about 70 of them, were assured again by the sheriff that this guy was safe. But as they were returning to their cars to return to Greenwood, an old white man approached one of the largest, most prominent Negroes and asked him what he was going to do with the pistol he was carrying. And from that exchange, he grabbed for the gun. A shot went off, and then all hell broke loose. Shots were fired in both directions. Both whites and blacks fell. The blacks quickly retreated across the tracks into their own community, and that's where it should have ended. This was about 10 o'clock at night on May 31st, 1921. But instead, what happened over the course of that night, the whites massed themselves in these large numbers all along the border of Greenwood. And at 5:08 a.m. on June 1st, there was some sort of whistle that blew that was obviously a sign for the attack to begin. And by noon of that day, Greenwood was completely decimated. 300 people were dead. Mm-hmm. Thousands had fled into the hills, and thousands more had been rounded up into concentration camps in white Tulsa.
Let's back up a little bit on this, though, because there certainly is some question as to when the shot was fired and who fired the shot. There's certainly a lot of question as to what happened in that elevator. And then there was a prior lynching, was there not, of a white man before some of this emerged? You mentioned this in your book, which I must add, you have developed as an historical novel almost, and you are almost there with the people as you read that book. So back it up a bit to some of those events that happened before that elevator, and also the relationship of that young man with that young girl who he did know.
Well, I think that, to back up, I think a crucial element to this is World War I, in which tens of thousands of African-American soldiers fought in Europe and demonstrated, really for the first time since the Civil War, demonstrated en masse their allegiance, their loyalty to the United States. And I think that as they came home, they felt like that their loyalty would result in better treatment of Negroes in the United States after the war. But what in fact was the case was, if anything, things had gotten worse. But through the writings of people like W.E.B. Du Bois and others, there was this feeling among this group of people that they were not going to be quiescent in this kind of treatment anymore. So there was this segment of the black population, including that in Greenwood, which predictably were going to respond to something like Dick Rowland's arrest in the way that they did. Mm-hmm. But also, it was perfectly understandable that they would have little confidence in the law enforcement to protect this prisoner, because only a few months before, as you say, a white prisoner who was accused of murder in Tulsa was swept out of the jail by a lynch mob and taken outside of town and hung while the Tulsa police directed traffic. And it was reported in the white newspapers afterward as a valid lesson to potential criminals. In the black newspaper of Tulsa, of course, it was seen much differently. It was seen as an example of the lawlessness, and it was pointed out even then that if this could happen to a white prisoner, can you imagine how a black prisoner would be treated?
So there was really no thought at the time of the more recent incident that there would be any sparing of Dick Rowland down there.
It makes perfect sense, and everything that I've been able to determine was that this Negro group went down to the courthouse and acted lawfully in every respect. You know, when the sheriff told them to return to Greenwood, they did, or at least were in the process of doing so when the shot was fired. The other question that has been a matter of speculation around Tulsa for 80 years is, what was the relationship between Rowland and this 16 or 17-year-old white girl, Sarah Page? Rowland's mother later told an interviewer that Rowland had taken a shine to her to some effect, or to some extent. The nature of their relationship wasn't completely clear to her, other than there was some kind of a relationship, and that in fact, after the conflagration in Tulsa, the two of them met up again in Kansas City and had some sort of a relationship, which I guess speaks to the fact that if anything happened on that elevator that day, it might have been as much a lover's quarrel as anything. And, you know, but the truth, as we say, and as I know you know, in an era when, you know, a Negro was lynched in the United States every week, and those lynchings often precipitated by these dubious charges of assault, sexual assault on white women, the truth wasn't terribly relevant at that time.
It was a time also of Jim Crow, and of course the separation of the races was very clear. And wasn't there some sense too that the black community had built up such a fine residential and business area that there was a little bit of jealousy across the races?
Well, I would say that there was a lot of jealousy. And one of the things that I think is, to me, as a white person researching this, as I began to research it, and as I was first introduced, and I wasn't completely unaware that this had happened until essentially the winter of 2000, when a wire story crossed my desk at the newspaper. But when I first heard about it, I had just assumed that it was some sort of historical accident, some terrible historical accident that kind of popped up, as these things occasionally do. But what I found as I began to research it was that rather than an accident, you know, in Tulsa was the worst incident of its kind in our nation, you know, since the Civil War. But rather than an accident, it was actually a metaphor for that period of our history, and completely consistent with what had been going on across the country, both North and South at that time. And so when this thing happened, it was something that had been going on all across the country at the time.
Yeah, there were some other riots in some other cities and other states during that time.
East St. Louis, Chicago, Houston, Washington, D.C., Atlanta.
And Arkansas.
Arkansas. All over the country. These people, I guess the point I was wanting to make earlier is that one of the things that contributed to a lot of these things is the jealousy. You know, after the Civil War, it seemed like it just did not pay for an African-American to be too obviously successful.
The term is uppity.
And by being successful in so many cases, particularly in the South, it made the Negro a target. And such was the case in Greenwood. Blacks by the thousands had come to Tulsa to profit from this oil discovery that had been made there certainly after the turn of the century. And the way they did this was by working as the mammies and the chauffeurs and the gardeners and the laundresses and the cooks for the newly wealthy white people. And they took that money back across the tracks. And, of course, because of Jim Crow, they couldn't shop in the white stores and they couldn't go to the white doctor. So this professional class emerged in Greenwood, a very proud and noteworthy professional class of doctors and lawyers and preachers and teachers. And it was a remarkable community and one that was known in the by African Americans across the nation, but one that by virtue of the times elicited tremendous jealousy on the south side of the tracks in the white community of Tulsa. So it's almost like you get the sense that Tulsa whites were almost looking, just waiting for an excuse, waiting for a match to kind of light this tinderbox of racial hatred and jealousy. And that I think, is what that newspaper editorial provided in the spring of 1921.
You're listening to University Forum. We're discussing Tulsa, the race riot, as it's been called, of 1921. My guest, Tim Madigan, discussing his recent book, The Burning. Mr. Madigan, let's talk a little bit about what did happen as a result of the actual assault, if you will, of the black community. What happened after the assault took place, and what was involved in that assault besides guns?
Well, when this whistle blew at 5:08 a.m. on June 1st, I think that it was pretty obvious that the African American community knew this assault was coming, and they had entrenched themselves as best they were able in their homes and businesses, and repelled or fought off the white invaders, as it were, for a good period of time that morning. But they were obviously outnumbered and had a shortage of ammunition and were eventually overrun. When that happened, in groups of 10 to 12, these white people went from house to house, calling the blacks out of their houses, killing them, shooting them if they didn't come, shooting men in the houses where firearms were found. There are numerous stories of atrocities of families being burned alive or shot down and their houses burned around them, of an old couple shot in the backs of their heads as they prayed and their houses burned. And then after the blacks were driven out, the whites, women and teenagers with shopping bags would come behind them, loot the homes, take all the valuable possessions. What they didn't take, they smashed on the floors. And then the coal oil or the gasoline would be spread on the walls of the houses, and the torch would be lit.
Something else, though, happened as far as a weapon from the sky.
Well, that has been a question of some debate. And there's no question in my mind that five or six airplanes that were the property of the Tulsa Police Force were flying over as thousands of Greenwood residents fled their community. Were flying over Greenwood, firing down at these people from the air. I mean, there is just dozens of oral history accounts that are highly consistent with that. And I begin the book with the account of a woman by the name of Eldoris McConderse, who was a little girl about 10 years old at the time, and she remembers the bullets from the air and these terrifying machines flying around them, and the bullets falling around her in the dirt like heavy raindrops. A lot of the black people also insist that Molotov-type cocktails or similar incendiary devices were dropped from the air and contributed to the attack. I hold back a little bit before stating that in my book, but clearly airplanes were used as weapons against what eventually was a defenseless group of people who were fleeing down the railroad tracks and down the country roads outside of Tulsa.
Yeah. We're really talking about a full-fledged assault on an area, a geographical area, which was on the other side of the tracks, it's euphemistically called the other side of the tracks,
right,
from the white community. During this time, when they were being assaulted and burned out, you said some things as you went through your book about what was happening or not happening to the prisoner. There was some question as to whether or not he was still there in the jail. Had he left by then? Who, you know?
Well, after the shooting at the courthouse, the attention of the white mob, Dick Rowland became an afterthought. The attention of the white mob was then directed toward bigger things, toward the whole community. And ironically enough, as this decimation of Greenwood was ongoing, the sheriff of Tulsa, a guy by the name of William McCullough, snuck Dick Rowland out of the jail and drove him to Kansas City, as best as anyone's been able to know in the years since, where he was held for a period of a couple of months and then eventually released because the charges against him were dropped.
Mm-hmm. So an event that precipitated this ended up in a whole other segment of history. Hardly his name mentioned in most places. The real event was what happened to the community.
The real event was what happened in the hours afterward, and you know that what the fact that Dick Rowland wasn't prosecuted is one of many great tragic ironies in all this. But in fact, no one was prosecuted. The only person who ever stood trial in all of this was the chief of the Tulsa Police, who was accused of dereliction of duty. 70 indictments were returned after a special investigation by the Oklahoma Attorney General, 50 of them against black people. But of those 70 indictments, not one person was ever convicted, and only a few people ever spent more than a few hours in jail within weeks after this.
But at the time that the blacks were being herded away from their homes, describe what that scene looked like. There are some pictures of that. In fact, Dr. John Hope Franklin's father was there at that time.
Right, right.
So there are some pictures of that. What was happening? What is that famous picture or infamous picture of the people who had so much, and some of them, many of them professionals? What happened to them?
Well, one of the things that happened is they were rounded up by the mob and later by the National Guard that arrived in Tulsa at about 11 o'clock that morning after everything was pretty much over with. They were rounded up and they were herded through the streets of Tulsa with their arms in the air at gunpoint into places like the Tulsa Convention Center or the baseball park, places large enough to hold large groups of prisoners with their arms in the air. And if they dropped their arms, the bullets would be fired at their feet. And while the whites of Tulsa lined the streets and cheered. And there is a couple of accounts of blacks actually being killed as they were marched down the streets. And, you know, we're talking about probably thousands of people who were treated this way. Thousands more fled down the railroad tracks, the Midland Valley Railroad tracks, in the kind of procession that we've gotten used to seeing in the Balkans, I think,
mm-hmm.
Into the countryside where they stayed for hours or days. For obvious reasons, massive throng, this long throng of refugees, which you know, it's surreal and unbelievable to think that it happened in this country. I mean, we've come to congratulate ourselves, I think, on the fact that we are more sophisticated and incapable of such barbarousness. But at least in 1921, we were more than capable, and I think that the ruthlessness that was displayed by the white community in Tulsa in those days was something that would rival anything of the Holocaust or anything that we've come to hear in Somalia or the Balkans.
The black community members who were herded, did they not have to have passes in order to either be excused from wherever they were held and have a white person sort of talk for them and speak up for them?
There was, in the days and weeks afterward, if and when you returned to Tulsa, and hundreds if not thousands of blacks never did, they didn't stop until they got to Kansas City or Chicago or Los Angeles, little Tulsa community spring up in cities all over the country. But if you did come back, you were herded into concentration camps. And the only way to get out of those camps is if your white employer came to vouch for you and take you with them.
On next week, our conclusion on the Tulsa Massacre. A very special thanks to my friend Dr. Gene Moore for guest hosting the program. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.